Hi. I was wondering, Indu, you talked a lot about like diversity of tactics, and well, all of you did in some way, but I just was wondering if you all could reflect upon the organizing that's happening against the Olympics right now, and also the fact that so much of it has been Native-led and this kind of work around solidarity organizing and how it's so cross-Canadian.
Well, on the face of it, when you're, I guess, talking to someone who's relatively new to the issues, the idea of using the Olympics as a springboard to talk about colonialism and native land rights seems a bit odd, but there's a stunning job that's been done by frontline organizers, mainly Indigenous organizers, to bring that forward. And I think a lot of the lessons from previous mobilizations are being applied. In Montebello, for example, in 2007, we put out a solidarity statement which said, look, we might have differences about what works or doesn't work in given situations, but let's not let the police and let's not let the media mediate our debates. Let's have our debates amongst each other unmediated in the situations of our own choosing. So similarly, you know, for the Olympics, that's come out because it runs the gamut from, Madame Monsieur Tout le Monde, so-called Madame Monsieur Tout le Monde, who don't like the fact that their city's being disrupted by this spectacle, to people who are openly calling for sabotage. And any movement that's worth that name needs to accommodate both and have that discussion. Your question's pretty huge, and there's a lot of different directions it can go in, but it's really timely because the CSIS visits, the Canadian Security and Intelligence Service visits that have been paid to organizers all over the country are related to this. The torch is being protected in exactly the same way that an internationally protected person would be protected, like a president of the United States or something. So it's important to, I think, recall why respect for diversity of tactics. Where is that coming from? It doesn't mean you can't be a pacifist. It just means let's create a context where, you know, we don't let the state divide ourselves. And that's definitely what these visits are about. And a lot of the media is about, and there's been an amazing solidarity that has been maintained, and I'd like to think that part of the reason why that solidarity is being maintained is because of the lessons that we have learned from Seattle. Like I said, one of the main ones was I just hated seeing people that I respected denouncing other people that I respected because they decided to mask up and smash Nike, in Seattle.
I would just add a little bit to that. A lot of the discussions have been happening since Seattle. Like, a lot of those people have been working together for many, many, many years. And when the Olympic bid was first put forward, the discussions started being had back when I was still living in Victoria. There was discussions of what was going to happen and how that was going to happen. And a lot of the people who ended up working together met through previous struggles against Campbell, actually, around a lot of the stuff that was affecting people, poor people especially. So that I think is, it's a wider question, and a lot of us do have a lot of different relationships, and we changed with those relationships given the circumstances that we're under. So I would just say that, ideas change and people change with the organizing circumstances that are there. There's a question back there.
I just wanted to add, because it's probably the good time to mention that there's actually four events coming up around this, some that provide a space to talk about it more. I won't give all the details because there's some flyers and stuff, but there's an art auction by Sandrine Lee Skillshare on Saturday, Creative Resistance Against the 2010 Olympics. There's a panel and discussion this Sunday at the DeSev Cinema with two Indigenous organizers from the interior of British Columbia, Billy Pierre and Miranda Dick. Q-Team and St. Emily Skillshare is organizing another film night on December 9th, and then the torch relays in town. As well, I'd add that the Dominion put out a special issue on the Olympics, so you can probably check that out as well. So all of this, like, sort of for me, is like a source of like the strength of movements. Like, they're not going to be huge events or anything, but it does show that we're being intentional about like trying to make links and stuff, and I encourage people to check out all or as many of those events as you can.
I've got a comment, not a question. I hope that's okay. Yeah. As you can probably tell, I'm an interloper. I'm not actually from Montreal, and I don't live here. I'm just visiting. But I was in Melbourne in Australia at a similar protest, although on a bit of a smaller scale, to what happened in Seattle. And I've been an activist in Australia for the 10 years following that. So I feel like it's good to be part of this community. But one of the things I just wanted to say was that coming in here, if I'd just listened to the first two speakers on the left, I would have felt a little bit depressed because it's not my experience of Seattle or what it means today at all. I find it a really exciting thing to think about. I feel really inspired when I see a meeting on in Canada about it 10 years after the event. And I think it still holds an important place in the minds of lots of activists today that we need to feel excited about. It's a good memory to have. It wasn't a failure, it was a victory, and we want to continue that on. And that brings me to my second point, which was something I contest that the third speaker says. I think the war is really significant, and September 11th was extremely significant for the anti-capitalist movement. And I think the job of activists that have come through that movement should be to take arguments to the anti-war movement about imperialism, about how war is capitalism by other means, and how these things can link together. And I really dispute the idea that having hundreds of thousands of people on demonstrations is not as good if there's not people really not being violent, but taking direct action. I don't think that's true. The best demonstration I've ever been on in my entire life was in London against the Iraq War, and it was one of the most incredible moments because people bring their kids along. Everyone feels welcome. And I don't think that's necessarily counterposed to direct action. But to pretend that the demonstration is not as good because there's no direct action, I think is wrong. We should be trying to talk about ideas as much as having a sense of the importance of action. There's a place for these things. It's a strategy. It's not the singular motive of demonstrations, I think. But maybe other people can talk about these and this stuff and feel free to disagree with me at any time.
I didn't explain my points very well, admittedly, because both the things you say are true, that 9/11 and trying to link up with anti-war movements was important, and that large demonstrations are also important moments. I was trying to make, I guess, more of a nuanced point, which is that I find the 9/11 excuse too convenient an excuse, because there was intentionality around how to respond, like within hours, if not days, and then the weeks and the months afterwards, about trying to address what I talked about earlier, linking a certain anti-capitalist, anti-globalization, I hate that term, but anti-globalization politics with rooted movements that are fighting racism, racial profiling, and what have you. I guess there's specificity to regions and where you are, but for me, a No One Is Illegal movement came out of a response to 9/11. And that No One Is Illegal movement in Montreal and other places in Canada was heavily influenced by the whole Seattle movement. And the other point, all I was trying to say, though, was I don't want to counterpoise because it would be totally against what I was getting at about, like, different tactics and strategies, but it bothers me when that's the only tactic. And in the Montreal context, like, Échec à la guerre, doesn't want to go beyond this safe zone of saying all we are saying is give peace a chance on the streets. And at a certain point in time, you just have to scream and say, do something more, and engage that. And that's been an ongoing debate with people like Bloc the Empire and Échec à la guerre for several years here in Montreal. But you're right about the two things you say. I just wasn't able to explain my point very clearly, like this nuance that I'm trying to get at. And it's a nuance that's deliberately provocative because I think we need to be to push these debates forward.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I think what I took from the first two speakers was not so much a message of hopelessness as one of just being honest with ourselves about the fact that the terms of the struggle have changed, and we can't just continue to hold on to previous landmarks, and as you know, try to keep ourselves going as those landmarks get further and further away. And so I was hoping maybe both Ben and Indu could speak to what they see as things we should do while we're redefining ourselves.
Well, in regards to redefining and trying to get the inertia running back again and really feeling like our movement is very strong for those who don't feel that way, or I know that there's a lot of people also who feel like, you know, like, let's be really positive and let's really look at what we do have going on faces everything that we're facing. And I think that what I've seen a lot of people do and what I've done myself specifically to try and keep individually that inertia going and in my community that I live in is just getting really, really, really local and really focusing on the situations that are happening right in front of you. And they're all connected in the larger picture. The local issues of gentrification and poverty and indigenous rights and imprisonment, all of these things are connected to the larger struggle. And it's something that I think we failed to do in Seattle during 99, was really bring, besides the unions, was really bring a big, proper, local voice to Seattle in 99. And it's something that I and some other people have been trying to specifically focus on over the last 5 years. And it's been a way for us to keep active and keep using our resources and our energy in ways that we see are very positive and helpful and constructive. And hopefully that can bleed in to the larger movement going on. You know, so that's kind of what I/we have been doing.
I guess for me, it's a little bit vague. Like, I definitely think that we need to, like, I guess I'm somewhere in between. I think keeping it local is really, really, really important, and making a difference in where you are is really important. But I think living where we live, we have a responsibility to other people in the world. I mean, we live in the belly of the beast, to take back a phrase from 99. And I think with that there is a certain responsibility of making trouble in the belly of the beast where we live. So for me, it's, yeah, definitely keep it local. And, you know, I live in a neighborhood in which there are amazing number of community associations and an amazing, like, just amazing things that happen that I think fly under the radar of a lot of activists. And I think it's amazing the stuff that happens, like the kind of service provision that happens. For me, like, it's important to find a stopgap between the revolution and now. And what are we going to do in between? And I think that is the question I'm asking myself constantly. Like, I believe the revolution will come, but I don't know what it's going to look like, and I don't know when it's going to come. But before that, we need to do things to make people's lives better in the here and now. So those are just, like, some of the things. And I do think that solidarity work is the way to go. Standing with people in solidarity in whatever way that you can seems to be a good way of keeping it local and keeping it global at the same time. I know that those are pretty vague answers, but I think that's kind of where I'm at in my head. Aaron, do you
want to? I guess my question was for Indu. I just, like, wanted to touch on one of the things you were saying. You kind of briefly addressed it right there, but one thing you brought up was, like, how the fight can't just be with demonstrations. And I think, like, for me, what I was thinking about a lot when you guys were speaking was, like, one of my personal reference points was I was growing up in Toronto, and I was in Toronto at the time of Seattle, and then soon after Seattle there was the Queen's Park riots, so like the large demonstrations against the welfare cuts in Ontario. And I think that, you know, in terms of the trajectory, like of a lot of people my age and growing up in Ontario and seeing what was happening with the Harris government, and then watching the way the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty was organizing was a very interesting, inspiring model. So like being able to do mass mobilizations like June 15th, 2000, and then kind of like, I guess like fall back or not fall back, but just kind of also be able to go into like the day-to-day and, you know, do tenants' rights organizing and anti-police brutality organizing and stuff like that. And I guess like, so getting to my question is that, you know, if the movement isn't just going to be in the streets, and I agree with you, I think, and I fear a lot of times too that right now we're at this particularly kind of low point in terms of anti-capitalist organizing, and I kind of fear that, you know, we've like lost a little bit like the language around mass movement building and mass organizing, and yeah, so I just wanted to throw that out there, and maybe you guys could reflect on that. I don't know. Do you share this fear?
Well, you and I lived through the same period, Aaron. I think I met you around that time as well. I mean, like, I go back to this theme of the night for me, which is intentionality, right? Like, before Quebec City, post Seattle, there were very clear discussions about how we need to. One of the phrases was root our resistance. That nobody was arguing that in favor of summit hopping. People, you know, talked about how that was privilege and what have you. If you can go to a protest, go, but you need to build something more tangible. And that's where you organize and where you live. And, you know, we can be very specific about what those things were. Like, there was a group called CLAC Logement that formed. The CLAC was the anti-capitalist convergence, which existed for about 4 or 5 years, about a year before Quebec City, and continued going. And people talked about fighting gentrification in southwest Montreal. It had its own trajectory, and you can argue about why it doesn't exist or does, but I think when the CSA, the Centre Social Autogéré, came about now, there were a lot of lessons from that moment. There was something called CLAC Immigration that formed in 2000, 2001, that was working with a domestic worker by the name of Malcolm Salvador. And a lot of the discourse that we use today about domestic work and migrant workers and the rest of it was being talked about back then in the context of these mobilizations. And that led to, you know, movements like No One's Legal and Solidarity Across Borders. And I think, you know, with Montebello, I can go on and on and on about these examples, but Montebello in 2007 saw, you know, a little bit of that spirit show itself again, but it's going to look different the next time around. It might look the same, too. I mean, the G20 is going to be in Toronto next June and July. I'm not sure exactly what's happening in Toronto, but I get the feeling they're going to be making a massive call out to shut down. They might not say shut down, because you don't want to say shut down, you can't do it. So they might say disrupt, but, you know, do something against the G20, which might be at the Toronto Convention Center right in downtown Toronto. And again, like, to the extent to which that's rooted in ongoing organizing in Toronto and elsewhere, I think it'll last. Whether we are able to shut it down, whether it'll be a protest you come back from traumatized or a protest you come back from euphoric or a bit of both, it's hard to say. But I think at the very least, these discussion points like provide a place where we can have a bit of what I call intergenerationality. It's kind of weird talking about generations between people in their 30s and they're in their 20s, but for the most part, not everybody here is in their 30s and 20s. That importance of linking people who've experienced different points in time but are still organizing in their own ways, and then people who are relatively new to organizing and creating those shared spaces where we at least are seeing each other, right? That's sort of the building block of what becomes a movement. So 2010... has not just the Olympics, but this G20 and G8 gathering. And I think it provides a challenge, but I don't think it would be strategic to see that as dropping what we're doing to run off to something, but rather to see how that links with what we're already doing. And I think all of us are having those discussions in terms of those of us that are part of groups that are organizing against police brutality or for migrant justice or Palestine solidarity, about how do we take the specific issue or campaign that we're involved with and link that to broader movements of against capitalism. And the fact that it's not as big and not as exciting as it was, like, you know, whatever, 8 years ago, 7 years ago, 6 years ago, whatever it is for whatever person in the room. Like, for me, I go back to that. That's just the nature of struggle. it's just the nature of it. But let's just conceive of ourselves as being engaged in that struggle, and we'll find those inspirations. Like, I find them all the time. just with the people I'm working with who are fighting deportation, or who were in sanctuary or now out of sanctuary, or who fought a security certificate, just to give some examples that I know about, and I'm sure others can find them as well. So I think we should be intentional about being in struggle and intentional about what we're fighting, and then find those moments when all the pieces kind of match and we can bring it all together. But that's not something that's predictable. Like, making that into a science, I'm not saying you're doing that, but that's what becomes frustrating in these discussions for me. Like, what I said before about predetermining struggle, you can't. It's by engaging it that it just comes up flush against you in the face, and then you deal with it. And hopefully we'll have those lessons and have those resource people and have those materials and have these reference points there and continue to have them there so that we don't just simply repeat mistakes, or don't repeat them as often, because we will repeat mistakes.
I would respond to that in a few different ways. Just echoing a little bit of what Juggie says, I think every movement has an ebbs and flows, and I think it's important to look at long-term trajectories. I think this has been an amazing year. In fact, it's been an amazing few months. Like, just think of the major victories that our community of organizers have won just in the last little while. You know, Qatar's out of sanctuary, Adil's major victory. Those are things that have taken time and effort and a lot of people putting energy into. And I think that is a major victory. And those are maybe, some of those struggles were not the most glamorous and didn't have the most glamorous tasks attached to them. But I think glamour means different things to different people. And I think it's really important to remember that. So I wouldn't say that there isn't movement building. I wouldn't say that there isn't anti-capitalism. And I'd definitely say that it's not all doom and gloom. Those things have been really, really positive. I think in Montreal, we've seen a lot of ebb and flow in the last year. One really strong movement that we see that's been growing very amazingly is the movement against Israeli apartheid. And I do think that we can't underestimate the power of that movement. And, there is anti-capitalism attached to that, within that rhetoric. And I think it's really important to acknowledge just because we don't see people in the streets all the time doesn't mean that people aren't doing things to make change and to make a better world. It's just there's different manifestations of what it's going to look like, and it's important to sort of take two steps back when you think that things are wrong. And I do think that people need to take that time to take two steps back. So that's what I would encourage. Go have a cup of tea. Maybe it'll make you feel better.
So I think all three of you have mentioned activist trauma, and it's something that I've been thinking a lot about lately, especially with the summits coming up here in Canada, and thinking about maybe people I know going to those summits and coming back possibly traumatized. I was wondering if you could talk or speak to your experiences in potentially supporting people that have gone through that, and if you have any ideas of ways to prevent that.
One thing I specifically found effective was trying to prepare them before they go, so they know like what are the possibilities of the cause and consequences of them going there, and how that might make them feel, and what they might see, et cetera, et cetera. And that has been like what I've seen the most effective, in at least in my community. It's just prepping people before they go. And on the return, it's always really specific, to the individual. And and how they come back and how they see. When when I think of trauma for myself and for a lot of people that I've seen, the trauma a lot of times is actually a very thoughtful, retrospective, emotional trauma, and not necessarily an intense physical one, which it has been and can be, about where they were, what happened, and now they're back at home or wherever in their zone, and what that all meant. And I think that you can always really be supportive to those folks who are feeling that way, and just talk them through it and brainstorm with them. And it seemed to be very effective. It's been my experience, at least.
I see this like in terms of just overall health, and I guess what we need to do and what people have been trying to do over the years, and we're building on the work of a lot of people who have been involved as medics or in other roles that they played, often roles that, you know, aren't as, you know, glamorous or what have you as being on the front line. We, you know, need to build on demystifying sort of the fact that you can come out of a traumatic situation like being pepper sprayed or tear gassed or just, you know, not sleeping for a long time or being in an intense situation, and providing space for people to debrief that, to talk about it, to have, you know, to build the support network so people have that. For me, though, like I said, in terms of overall health, because those support networks, we should build them within our movements, right? We need to cultivate them, provide that space. But for each person, I think those support networks are different, and they don't necessarily come from activism and the organizing. You know, they come from family, they come from friends, they come from your partners, they come from distractions. This is a huge area we're getting into, but I think just having a culture where this is not mystified, like we break that taboo, which I think, I don't want to say it's totally broken, but it's being broken. Pardon me? The fact that you might be traumatized, or the fact that you're feeling burnt, or the fact that you're sad for an inexplicable reason, or all these different behaviors that aren't you being normal, quote unquote, for what, you know, like how you feel you should be normal, is in itself normal. And those are things that we all deal with, and we need to create a culture where we can talk about it, where we can provide that support, whether that comes from, you know, wherever that support comes from, wherever we find that strength. Because there's this macho dynamic of, you know, like you should just deal with it. And I don't think that that's tenable at all. I feel that, at least in certain medic networks and networks of support around actions, like we need to provide that space to debrief, to decompress, to talk it out and to talk about what's bothering people. And often, you know, that's also a long-term thing. Like what I add to that, though, is like that's also life, like part of any trauma in life, right? Like, there's different reasons why in activist settings there's causes of trauma. Definitely, like seeing a police officer beat somebody up to a pulp and you're there and you feel hopeless, or, you know, being the victim of or survivor of violence is one example of that in those situations. But there's so many others. It's an enormous topic, and I just feel. Having those support networks to talk about it, and seeing that again intentionally, sort of what Ben was alluding to, as a way in which we prepare. It's not just something, oh, it might happen, it might not happen, we'll worry about it when it happens, but rather as part of that preparation, just like anything else, like dealing with security culture questions or dealing with like who's going to bring the placards, that kind of stuff. So it's part of that broader support network that we build in struggle. And I feel like when I know I'm part of a movement, like I feel like I could talk to other people about it because they've gone through it. So like the strength of our movements provides a strength for dealing with those traumas or those traumatic situations.
For me, it's what has proven to be really, really important is intergenerational relationships. Having older people around has helped me deal with activist trauma so much. whether it's like the trauma of going to a big demonstration and feeling really overwhelmed, which tends to happen, or whether it's seeing somebody being beaten to a pulp, or whether it's like I'm having a bad day because I'm not getting along with people who I thought were comrades or I do still think are comrades. Whatever the case, I do think that intergenerational relationships are incredibly important for basic activist health. And I mean that in terms of younger and older relationships. Like, I find that I like being around young people because they have a lot of energy that I may not have anymore. And I like being around older people because they have a lot more experience and can talk me down from my own when I get worked up. So for me, those relationships are incredibly important. And one thing that I keep reminding a lot of my friends is to be friends with people who do activism differently from the way that you might, who have a different way of interacting with making change. Because I feel like that there are certain, whether it's just mood or whatever, that particular kinds of activist communities make. There's certain kinds of ways that people have interacting in different activist communities, and so it's good to break out of those cycles by talking to people that that do activism differently. I thought maybe that's a bit vague, but it helps. Yes.